Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 26th of January. A great political read is now out in paperback, and it's still a great political read. Adam Cohn is the author of Nothing to Fear: FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. It was a New York Times bestseller in hardcover, and it's an account of FDR and a special emphasis on the first 100 days in office, with a very deep accounting of all the people he brought into the cabinet and what the mood of the country was and how the Depression had hit so many Americans. It's a very, very good read, an important book. Adam is with us this hour of the program. He's a member of the New York Times editorial board, and he's author of this book. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Adam. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Adam, thank you so much for being with us again. Hi.
Hi, my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. Let's go to the end of the book for a moment, because I want to concentrate on a few of these people. 70 years ago, you write, Francis Perkins wrote to Harry Hopkins about their work in the 100 days of the FDR administration. A lot happened out of the determination of a few people. And then you go on to talk about the power of a few determined people to do good, as true today as it ever was, and your deep appreciation to people like Perkins, Wallace, and Hopkins, who exist in every part of the country. Why did you single out those three? I mean, I agree, they're extraordinary people.
Well, they were the three real progressives in the inner circle. Of the five people that I write about, one, Lewis Douglas, was the budget director who didn't believe there was money to spend on anything, so I didn't find him so heroic, although very interesting. Raymond Moley, the other member of the five, was sort of the guy who kept the wheels greased, and he wrote a lot of the speeches. These three, Francis Perkins, Harry Hopkins, and Henry Wallace, really had a vision of a better America and a commitment to take it there. And I found the three of them really inspiring.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about Francis Perkins and Henry Wallace, one being the conscience of the city and one being the conscience of the rural areas, both areas hurting so tremendously during the time in which they lived and they came to power.
That's right. Francis Perkins grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts, moved to Chicago, but spent most of her life really in New York City, living in Manhattan, and had a real compassion for city people and their problems. Henry Wallace was a third-generation farm journalist, editor of Wallace's Farmer, which his grandfather started. He was a farmer himself, went to all the farmer conventions, really cared deeply about farm families, and the two of them together really took care of their people, if you will.
And Frances' story is interesting, isn't it? She kind of said goodbye to the family and went to work for Hull House in Chicago.
Unbelievable story. And, you know, I grew up, I think, like many people, thinking that, you know, women's liberation really began in the 1960s, and much happened in the 60s, of course. But you see this woman, Frances Perkins, who back then in 1904, graduating from college, and just doesn't believe there are any limits to what she can do. She breaks off on her own. She works at Hull House, as you mentioned, the settlement house. She moves to Philadelphia and takes a job rescuing women who are being recruited by pimps at the docks, and she fights them off with an umbrella when they come after her.
Oh, my gosh.
She just is not afraid. She gets married and doesn't change her name. She just feels like such a modern person. It was really a remarkable thing to read about.
And doesn't know her way around Washington. You have great stories about her getting to the inauguration, her going to one of the events the night before, which she never got the word, don't go to this event. She just was kind of wandering on her own.
It's amazing how informal it all was and how confused they were. The story I also love is that when it was time for her to report to be the Secretary of Labor of the United States government, no one told her what to do or where to go. She actually had to look up the address of the department in the phone book and just head on over there.
You mentioned Raymond Moley. Let's talk about him for a while, because he was, by the early accounts of your book, very close to the president, spent more time with the president than any of the others.
Yes, he was the head of the Brains Trust during the campaign, so they came up with all the programs for the campaign, and Moley was the great speechwriter. He wrote that inaugural address, that first inaugural address that we all still remember so well. So an amazing figure. but also never quite found his place in the administration. He was a close advisor, but there were other close advisors. And eventually he and the president had a falling out that led Moley, whose politics were always fairly centrist, to become a critic of FDR, a critic of the New Deal. And he ended his life as, you know, as a Goldwater Republican. So he's one of the people who really didn't end well between him and FDR.
Yeah. And how do you explain FDR having him as the head of his brain trust when you've got people with much more progressive ideas taking us into a whole new phase of government in America? How did he get there?
Well, in a way, he was sort of perfect because he was a Columbia University professor of political science, so he's very learned. He had access to other academics, and really FDR wanted to bring other academics into the Brains Trust to come up with good ideas. So he was well-connected. Columbia, of course, was the great educational institution in New York State where FDR was governor, so all that made sense. And also, FDR is at heart, you know, was in many ways a pragmatist. He wanted to help the victims of the Depression, but he wasn't wedded to progressive ideology. He was also believed in a balanced budget. He was a fiscal conservative. So I think someone like Moley, who didn't have a strong ideology, was just the sort of person he wanted to sort of bring people together, get all the ideas on the table. And if FDR wanted to be progressive, Moley was perfectly willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Let's spend some time on this. Roosevelt arrived in Washington with no firm commitments apart from his promise to try something. The question he was most torn over, and it's hard for us to believe that he didn't go into office with all of this in his head, was whether to undertake large-scale and enormously expensive programs to help the Depression's victims. He did just that, but he was torn over doing that?
He really was. And, you know, we forget now just how small government was when FDR took office. Under Herbert Hoover, the idea was the federal government essentially was just responsible for defending the country and delivering the mail. So we now are used to these big, big administrative agencies in Washington doing all kinds of ambitious things. It was considered so radical back then. So FDR was willing to try it, but it was a bold move, and certainly putting millions of people to work at government jobs, that sounded, you know, very radical and also very expensive. And FDR was at heart a very thrifty, balanced budget kind of guy. So he was torn. But in the end, the progressives around him convinced him that what was most important is so many families were suffering, and it was more important to do something for them than to worry about the balanced budget.
Mm-hmm. And you spend quite a bit of time talking about the suffering seen through the eyes of Perkins and Wallace and just the general suffering. Can you describe that? Because it's hard still, even though we're in rough times now, it's hard to imagine how hard it was for so many Americans.
That's right. I mean, things are not good now, but then it was 25% unemployment. The stock market had fallen 85%. You would walk down big cities like New York City, and you'd see in the street families would be sitting on the sidewalk surrounded by their furniture and their belongings with no idea where to go. They had been thrown out on the street. There was no food stamps and things like that. So literally, I write about how in garbage dumps there were fights over scraps of food. People just literally were trying to survive. So it was a much rawer form of poverty, and not that things are necessarily great now, but, you know, huge Hoovervilles where people would build these shack cities, which in Central Park there was a Hooverville. So there was just a lot more raw need and despair, and this was an environment that FDR, you know, came into, and everyone understood the government had to do something to change it.
Let's make a little bit of a comparison to now. Obviously, we're dealing with an unemployment which is not 25%, which FDR faced, but it is 10% right now. There wasn't any money. There wasn't any food. Can you tell me how he made the decision and how difficult it was for him to maneuver through Congress, a decision to put a lot of people back to work, to start major programs, to infuse the economy with money so that people could eat and work?
Yeah, well, those first public works programs, again, I come back to Frances Perkins. She was the one who really kept fighting for them, and there was something called the National Industrial Recovery Act, which was the big, big bill that ends up passing at the end of the 100 days, and everyone knew it would be a big program to try to help get industry back on its feet. But the details were always very sketchy, different people had different ideas. Frances Perkins went to every meeting of the cabinet, every meeting of the drafters of the NIRA, and said, whatever you do, there has to be a big public works program. And she fought and fought and fought. And Lewis Douglas, that conservative budget director, was going to FDR and saying, we don't have the money for this. And in the book, I tell a really entertaining story about how Perkins wins and prevails and gets over $3 billion put into the NIRA for public works. And then Douglas goes around her back to FDR, gets the money taken out, and Perkins goes around his back one more time and gets it put back in. So it was not foreordained. It wasn't that FDR was firmly committed to it. But I think it was people like Perkins and later Harry Hopkins who really told him, we need these government jobs. Not that government jobs are the best answer, but they were the answer at that time.
Mm-hmm. There surely must have been some reluctance on the part of Congress, though, to branch into all this new territory, right?
Well, there was, but, you know, it was an overwhelmingly Democratic Congress, and even Republicans were hearing from their constituents, give the president what he wants. You know, we need to get out of this mess that we're in and let the president lead. So it's amazing the degree to which Congress rubber-stamped almost everything that FDR, you know, sent to them. And in a couple of places, they actually knew better than him. One thing that's very sort of surprising to read today is that FDR really opposed federal deposit insurance, which is a, you know, obviously a critical thing that keeps our banking system so secure now. The idea that if you put money in, you know you'll get it out. FDR just didn't believe in it. He thought it would be, you know, a tax on the richest banks, and he was a little nervous about it. It was Congress that insisted that that go in. So occasionally Congress knew better than FDR, but mainly they took his lead, and I think they were right to do that.
Yeah. And tell me about what he did with the banks in the early days of his administration, the bank holiday that was declared, how he got people to feel that they had trust in their banking system again.
Yeah, there was a bank holiday, and the big question was, would the banks ever reopen? They had closed because there were all these runs on banks. People were running down and trying to take out all their money, and there wasn't enough money in the banks, so they would run out of money and they would shut down. So the question was, could you reopen the banks in a way that people wouldn't all run to take out their money? So he came up with this Emergency Banking Act where he had his Treasury Department officials go through the banks, see which ones were healthy enough to reopen, reopen only the healthy ones, not reopen the ones that weren't healthy. And then he did an amazing thing. He had this first fireside chat on a Sunday evening where he talked to the American people, told them plain and simple what he had done to make the banking system safe. He explained it so clearly, Will Rogers said, that even the bankers understood the banking system when he was done. And he told people, you know, I'm going to reopen the banks tomorrow, Monday morning, but don't run out and take out all your money. Put your money in. It's safer in the banks than under your mattress. And you know what? The next day, people did actually go in and put their money into the banking system. And that was a sign that we had really turned a corner.
And did he do that through the fireside chat? Was that one of the early ones, or was that later?
Yes, that was the first fireside chat. And it was so successful and so popular that it became a mainstay of his presidency. And, you know, we forget what life was like without televisions, but, you know, you've seen these pictures. The entire family, from grandma and grandpa to the little kids, all gathered around the radio listening to the president's voice.
Just like it'll be tomorrow night for the president's address. We'll all gather around the television, right, Adam?
The big plasma screen, yes.
The big plasma screen. Give me more of a sense of what was going on in Roosevelt's mind. You talk about his inner circle having enormous influence. Is that because FDR really didn't have strong opinions and ideas about things and he was willing to be formed? Or what was it? What kind of leadership and creativity came from him?
I think that's right. You know, he had strong views, but often they conflicted. He really did want to help people. He really wanted programs that would rescue the victims of the Depression. But he also really believed in a balanced budget. He was a thrifty guy. He didn't believe in spending a lot of money. So he had all these views, and he didn't really understand economics that well. So when he knew that he had to do something for the farmers, he didn't know what that something was. So Henry Wallace came in and said, we have to have a big program for the farmers. And the first thing FDR said to him is, go convene a meeting of all the farm leaders, find out what the farmers want. Mm. And so he was very open. And when Wallace came back and said, here's what the farmers want, they want a system where we'll pay farmers not to grow, so we'll get the crop levels down. FDR was very open to that. He was always looking for good ideas. He didn't have preconceived ideological, you know, sense of where things had to go.
Would you call him a progressive? Was he a progressive when he was elected governor of New York?
Yeah, he was a progressive, and he stood for things that really made him progressive. He was the first governor, really the first major political leader to come out for unemployment insurance, and that was a speech that Frances Perkins largely wrote for him, and she really encouraged him to give. So, and he also was the first governor to have a state relief program to actually give money to the unemployed. So he was progressive, but it was always a pragmatic kind of progressivism. He wasn't, he would listen to people like Frances Perkins and Harry Hopkins, but he was a little different from them. He had to be persuaded, whereas they, completely believed this stuff.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for Adam. We're talking with Adam Cohn this hour of the program about his book, Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. The book is now out in paperback, and it looks at primarily the first 100 days of FDR's presidency, which was, as you know, at the very height of the Depression. He spends a great deal of time talking about five members of FDR's inner circle, and you can tell he has particular admiration for three of those people, Harry Hopkins and Frances Perkins and Wallace as well. And so we're welcoming phone calls as we prepare for a presidential address tomorrow night. There have been a lot of comparisons made between the two times in American history and a lot of criticism of the current president that he hasn't branched into territories to really create more jobs in the country. He'll address more of that tomorrow. But there are some comparisons in terms of the economy being very bad. People are out of work, et cetera. So feel free to join our conversation. It really shaped modern America, this presidency, too, and so is worthy of our examination. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that. That address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. John Anderson is answering phones for us today, and he'll just chat with you for a minute and get you on the air, and then we'll talk with you on the air. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Cohn is our guest, and the book is Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. Adam is a member of the New York Times editorial board. And we start calls with Jeff from Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. Great topic. I think it's relevant to connect our current troubles with the past. I have a general question. I don't really know the facts. Did Roosevelt, in his years as president, did he nationalize any industry, and what does that mean legally when you have to present that to Congress? And is that socialism? The reason I ask is I'm of the opinion that if we nationalize the oil industry, we could pay for a lot of our programs. But, of course, you have to do that legally and use the profits for everyone's benefit. I was wondering if that ever happened under Roosevelt.
Go ahead, Adam.
Oh, no, he didn't. And he was actually worried about being called a socialist just like Obama is. So that wasn't his approach. What he tended to do was to expand the role of government, make government an employer. And he also, with the National Industrial Recovery Act, had set up some boards where the government would work with leaders of industry to try to set prices and things like that, which some people thought was socialism, and that ended up being a failure, and the Supreme Court struck it down. Nationalizing an industry is a very tricky thing, because what you're essentially doing is taking property that once belonged to private shareholders and trying to give it to the government or whatever, and that does cut against the grain for a lot of people in terms of what private property means. Some people did feel with the bank bailout that the government should have had more say in the running of some of these banks, since a lot of government money went to them, but that wouldn't have quite been nationalization. I think for a lot of people, that's if people who fear socialism, that really does begin to approach socialism. Mm.
Can you talk a little more about what Jeff was discussing, connecting current troubles with the past? And let me just frame it in terms of parts of the first 100 days or the early days of the FDR administration that we could learn from now.
Yeah, I mean, I think FDR's approach was really a good one. I mean, it was very ambitious. He was not afraid of doing very big things, things that would last for, you know, decades. So a lot of his solutions were things that we still see, like federal, you know, deposit insurance, like, you know, programs that emerged in 1935, like Social Security, unemployment insurance. These are still with us. So he thought very boldly and also was very pragmatic. He had a very good eye for how far he could go and still get, you know, the approval of Congress, still get the American people to be behind him and to vote for him in the, you know, his party in the midterm elections. So I think that combination of bold thinking but real sort of pragmatism and political head counting, it was a very effective model for hard times.
And what happened in those first midterms following his election?
Well, you know, it's sort of conventional wisdom that the party in power always loses seats in a midterm election, and, you know, we'll see if that happens this year. But actually, the Democrats picked up houses in both, picked up seats in both the House and Senate, which was an indication to FDR that he could go even further, which he did in 1935. The people actually wanted, you know, more reform, more change.
Thanks, Jeff, so much for your call. Steve is next. Hi, Steve.
Yes, thanks for having me on. I just, in the run-up to the election in 2008 and shortly thereafterwards, there were some occasional references to FDR and Obama and so forth. And on a bit of a facetious yet, I think, substantive note, I wondered if there was anybody like Rahm Emanuel in FDR's inner circle.
No, it's a great question. And, you know, there was. I mean, it depends what you think Rahm Emanuel is like. But if we take him as being someone who's very political, very strategic, you know, a very sort of canny political mind, for FDR, that was a guy named Lewis Howe. Lewis Howe was this upstate New York journalist who ended up glomming onto FDR very early in his career and really becoming his campaign manager and plotting all of his runs. Lewis Howe and Eleanor were the ones who convinced FDR to run for governor after he got polio and it seemed like he might not remain in public life. And Lewis Howe sort of plotted every step of the way for him. And Howe was in the White House. So I think that that was sort of an Axel, that was a sort of a Rahm Emanuel or Axelrod-like figure. And my question is more, are there people in the Obama administration like Perkins and Wallace and Hopkins? Certainly not with the high profiles that those three had.
Yeah, I guess I asked my question, my point of view, Rahm Emanuel, at least according to a lot of blogging on the so-called liberal blogosphere, has probably been more responsible than anyone for sort of steering Obama away from the kind of bold moves that FDR did take in his first 100 days.
Ah, that's another aspect of Rahm Emanuel, yes, and I actually was reading that on some blogs today. Yes, I mean, and that would really be Lewis Douglas, who was FDR's budget director, and Douglas was a fiscal conservative. He was very close to FDR. FDR actually early on thought that he wanted Lewis Douglas to succeed him as president, so a very close advisor, and Lewis Douglas believed there wasn't money for any of these programs. So anytime Francis Perkins suggested we need public works programs, we need social welfare programs, Douglas was in there fighting against them. So, yes, I mean, I think, you know, presidents like to have someone there to say, you know, we got to put our foot on the brake, let's not go too far. And each of these presidents had someone like that.
Hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve, very much for the call. When you look at the substance of the New Deal and all of the programs and the heart of the New Deal, it really is related to the work that Perkins, Wallace, and Hopkins did. That's what we remember from this. What were their relationships with the president? Did he warm to them? Were they outsiders? How did they get what they envisioned?
Well, they were very close to him. Frances Perkins, you know, went back with him the furthest. She worked for him when he was governor of the state of New York. He inherited her from Al Smith, his predecessor. He trusted her judgment very much, brought her to Washington, and she was actually one of only two cabinet members who stayed with FDR his entire administration. So there were some problems later in, you know, in her tenure. She was red-baited a little bit, but FDR never thought of replacing her. So no one was with him longer professionally than her from, you know, beginning of the governorship to the end of the presidency. Harry Hopkins is someone who the president just fell in love with, and he always had some male advisor who he was very close to, who, you know, because he was a lonely guy. I mean, he was having affairs with women, as we know, but he also liked to have a best friend. And after Lewis Howe died, I mentioned, Harry Hopkins was that person. Harry Hopkins ended up moving into the White House with his wife. That's how close they were. And Henry Wallace, FDR, had great, great regard for and actually made his vice president. So these were three people who were really in the inner circle.
You bring it down to such a human level when you say FDR liked to have a best friend.
He did. He was a lonely guy.
He was a lonely guy.
Yeah.
It's hard to think of a president as being a lonely guy, isn't it?
Yeah, but when you read about FDR, it's so true. I mean, it's so funny that he always needed to have, like, really a best friend, often living with him in the White House. Lewis Howe lived in the White House, too. He liked that, yeah.
We go next. Thank you, Steve, for your call. Kurt from Chippewa Falls is next. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. I was wondering if the guests could back up a little bit and provide a little more background. My understanding is, well, obviously, nothing comes out of a vacuum. FDR and his advisors, his government at the time, there had been increasing economic maldistribution, to use a fancy word, ever since the post-Civil War Gilded Age. It was the period of immense immigration in the United States, and the immigrants were piling up in the slums. That's where we have the shelters and the Hull House and so forth. The perception of what was going on in Russia at the time was that the communists were creating the perfect society and the perfect economy, and that was getting some traction among the workers and the unions, which of course were not all of one mind either. It was a very diverse and rich and conflicted age in politics, economics, and what have you. There is some school of thought that the only reason Roosevelt was able to get the political and the financial powers of the day to go along with his alleged socialism was that it was to head off the growing civil and worker unrest in the country. So I'd like to, you know, does the book deal with that? Maybe I'll ask it that way.
Okay.
Great question. Also, I think you laid out a lot of the history really well right there. This is all true. And, you know, there's so many ways to answer. But one view of the New Deal, the 1930s, is that it really was just the flowering of the Progressive Era. And the Progressive Era was formed by the very forces that the questioner mentioned, which was the rise of capital, the rise of big industry, and that's when there were some liberal ideas about pushing back against some of that. And that actually, a lot of those progressive ideas began in Wisconsin. A lot of the ideas for unemployment insurance and things like that were developed by professors in Madison, Wisconsin. So a lot of it is a reflection of that. But yes, there also was the Soviet Union. There were very strong socialist and even communist parties in the United States. And, you know, people like Norman Thomas, running for president as a socialist, actually polled very well. And FDR kind of co-opted some of that. So, you know, historical forces are always so complicated. There's so many things going on. But it's true. This did not just begin on March 4th, 1933, by a long shot.
Mm-hmm. Could we, excuse me, go back, because we haven't spent much time with him, to Harry Hopkins for just a moment, to, as you write, really wasn't part of the brain trust or the campaign apparatus, but got him. How did he get himself in that inner circle? And also, we should talk about his work with the Federal Emergency Relief Act, Adam.
Yeah, Hopkins is just one of my favorite characters. So he, you know, at age 22, he graduates from college in Iowa, and he gets on a train and moves to New York, to the Lower East Side, the most densely populated poor immigrant neighborhood in the United States. Works in a settlement house and just dedicates his life to helping the poorest people in the country. Works for the Tuberculosis Association. Becomes head of the first state emergency relief program for Governor Roosevelt. But he still doesn't know Roosevelt. So when Roosevelt is elected president, he's desperately trying to, you know, get a federal emergency relief program going, and he wouldn't mind heading it, but he can't get an appointment in the White House. He actually calls up Frances Perkins, who he knows a little bit from New York, meets with her in the women's women's club where she's staying during the inauguration the first few weeks, and persuades her about the importance of this program. She says, let me take it to the president. She sells him on the idea, and then, by the way, they end up picking Harry Hopkins to run it. And Harry Hopkins then becomes this person who's writing these large checks to different states to fund emergency relief so that they can give out food and shelter to the needy. But he believed in relief, but he really believed in work, as did FDR. So his goal was always to get federal government work programs going, and he did that. The WPA, which was sort of the flowering of federal government work programs, was Harry Hopkins doing, and he put people to work doing everything from building bridges to interviewing the last surviving slaves and writing slave narratives. So it was an amazing thing, and Hopkins just embodied everything that was idealistic and activist and energetic about the New Deal.
There are all these wonderful people associated with this time, aren't there?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Here's an email that's come in from James from South Range, Wisconsin. I know she had a large role in the later part of his terms, but how much effect did Eleanor have on FDR in this early stage of his presidency?
Great question. You know, I thought when I began researching this that I'd be writing a lot about Eleanor, but it's amazing how little I ended up writing about her. She wasn't that big a force in the early days. I mean, I don't think it's true, as some people say, that she might not even have voted for her husband for president because she really didn't want to be first lady. She was very shy at the beginning, didn't really understand her role, wasn't that enthusiastic about it. So to the extent that, she comes up in the 100 days, she's, inviting reporters over to the White House and doing sort of traditional first lady-like things. And Frances Perkins is really the woman who's pushing these programs. That changes over time. And there's a very interesting sort of comparison between Eleanor and Frances, who people either want to think that Eleanor created Frances because, she wanted to have a woman, in the cabinet, or that the two of them disliked each other strongly because they were the two powerful women. But in fact, they got along fairly well. They weren't that close, but they had very different lives and careers. And, Frances Perkins always thought of herself as the woman who, worked really hard, went to college, got a graduate degree, worked her way up through the social worker and government ladder, and did it all herself, whereas Eleanor sort of married into it. So Eleanor became a huge force later, but not so much in the 100 days.
Hmm. Thanks, Kurt, so much for your call. Mike from Whitefish Bay. Hi.
Hi, I'd like to know when FDR became crippled. Was it when he was Secretary of the Navy or Governor of New York or when he was president?
Yeah, no, it was just before he was Governor of New York in 1920. And it was the sort of thing, he'd already been Secretary of the Navy, and he was on what seemed like a very promising trajectory, but it really almost ended his career. His mother, Sarah, very much wanted him to give up politics and just retire to the estate in Hyde Park and, tend to his stamp collection. But it was Eleanor and Lewis Howe who said, no, this isn't a permanent disability. It shouldn't be a disabling disability. And they encouraged him to run for office. And he did run for governor as a disabled person. And Frances Perkins, in her oral history, talks about how poignant it was for her to see him campaigning, where sometimes he would have to be carried up the steps or up a fire escape to speak to a crowd because, accessibility was so limited back then. But it didn't stop him. He did generally hide his disability. He didn't like to be seen in his wheelchair. There weren't many photographs of it because there was still a lot of stigma to disability, and he didn't want, he didn't really want the public to see that.
And particularly for being president, right? Are you strong enough? Are you a strong guy?
Absolutely. And, he had this one crazy cousin, Alice Longworth, who would attack him and say that, he's trying to make the country a cripple just like he is. So, there was a sort of nastiness about some of this. So he didn't really want to put it out there.
Did it develop his sense of empathy?
I think absolutely. And Frances Perkins talks about this in her memoir and in her oral history. She knew him as a young man, and she thought he was kind of a snotty Harvard graduate who looked down his nose on people. He was rich, and he was tall and handsome, and she didn't really care for him as a young man. She knew him a little bit socially, and they traveled in the same circles in Manhattan. She said once he became disabled, that his views of people and politics and life changed dramatically. And she said he felt that, you know, no one was inferior to him anymore because any person he happened to be talking to could walk and he couldn't walk. And she really does trace his empathy and really a lot of the social programs that emerged to his having become disabled. Polio.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. Ron LaCrosse, hello.
Yes, I have a question. The Supreme Court ruled that the NRA, National Recovery Administration, was unconstitutional back in 1935, and that was sort of the flagship of the New Deal. I heard the case that they heard with something to do with somebody who was dealing with poultry products or eggs. You know the details on that?
Yeah, Schechter Poultry, a kosher butcher in New York City. But, you know, that just happened to be the company that challenged it. But everyone sort of knew that the National Industrial Recovery Act was going to be declared unconstitutional. It was this very ambitious and a little bit crazy idea that the government would really convene these meetings of different industries and help them to set prices and set conditions of work. And particularly back then, when there was a pretty conservative Supreme Court, this just felt a lot like overreaching, like something that the federal government didn't really have the authority to do. So it was really a sitting duck for anyone to come along and challenge it. And, you know, FDR said that once it was struck down that he was kind of glad it was. It really had not been going very well. People weren't happy with it. And it really freed them up to try new approaches to the Depression.
Okay.
Okay, Ron?
Yeah.
Thanks. Tom from Burlington. Hi.
I have a little story about Roosevelt, and I'd like to talk about Mr. Wallace. I was a page in Washington, and James Roosevelt was FDR's son. And James was a tall, handsome-looking man. He went to Congress at the same year my father did in 1954. But James used to have cleats on his feet, on his heels. And there were those little kind of pie-shaped cleats. And when he would walk on the marble, you could hear him click, 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 click. And he was the only congressman that I saw that wore cleats. And I kind of felt that he wore those cleats because his father couldn't make that noise or something. I don't know. But anyway, that's what I was reading into it. Now, with Wallace here, Wallace, I believe, started the hybrid corn business or something. And here in Wisconsin, we have, when you go by the fields, they have Wallace. They'll show you a piece of ground that's a certain Wallace seed. But anyway, I'd like to ask you, Wallace was supposed to be maybe the vice president, and he was picked, and something happened, and Truman became the vice presidential candidate. Could you maybe talk about that?
Sure. You know, first, a word about the seeds. He was a great pioneer of hybridization, which was kind of a radical idea at the time. And while he was doing a million other things, he started a little seed company just on the side with some friends. And that grew into eventually becoming Pioneer Seeds, which was sold in the mid-'80s for, I think his family got several billion dollars.
Oh, my gosh.
No, so it's just he did so many amazing things, but just as a little sidelight, he started this amazing hybrid seed company. So that was an area where he definitely was a leader. He was vice president, and he would have loved to have been president, and came very close to it. He was president during the third term, and FDR's health was already declining, and people were worried that if Wallace remained vice president, he would become president. And by people, I mean the more conservative elements of the Democratic Party. So it's always been a little unclear exactly who ganged up on him and how, but it's thought that Southerners and some of the big city political bosses really leaned on FDR to dump Wallace as vice president, replace him with Truman, which was done with Roosevelt's tacit approval, and Truman, of course, became president. So Wallace really had a very different vision. He was much more liberal than Truman, and he came very close to being president. It might have been a very different timeline of history if that had been allowed.
Yes, it sure would. Thank you, Tom. Another Tom from River Falls. Hi.
Hey. Yeah, I wanted to ask your guests if you're familiar with a book by Cass Sunstein, who apparently is the most quoted legal scholar in the U.S., and I think he's on in Obama's administration right now. But he wrote a book called The Second Bill of Rights, FDR's Unfinished Revolution. And it's the 1944 State of the Union Address by FDR. and it enumerates eight economic rights that he wanted to implement before, I guess, in his last term. But then, of course, he died, like a year later. And I'm curious if you're familiar with that.
I'm familiar with Kastancian. Yes, he is. He is in the administration now. He's a Harvard Law professor and is now the sort of regulatory czar. He's going through all the regulations of the federal government and looking for ways to improve them. I'm not familiar with his book, and when people ask things like this, I always beg off and say, well, you know, my book is really about, 1933, so I don't really know stuff after that. But it's a great tip. I mean, that sounds like a fascinating book, and I'm going to go out and get it.
Thanks, Tom, very much for your call. Let's talk about farmers for a moment here. We tend to forget because we think of cities, but the number of farms that had fallen apart, the farm economy, as you write in your book, was on the brink of collapse when FDR took over. How did he deal with that, and who dealt with that? Who had the vision for rural America?
Sure, and this was a major crisis. I mean, sometimes people read this now and they think, well, how important is that? How many farmers are there, really? But there were so many farmers back then and so many people who relied on farmers for their livelihood, small towns across America. So the Farm Belt was a huge part of the population, and it had been actually suffering worse than the rest of the country. The Great Depression for the Farm Belt started in the 1920s, and it was worse when FDR came into office than it was in the city. So major crisis, and it really was Henry Wallace, who was a very prominent farm leader, farm journalist, very well known to all the farm organizations. He was the Secretary of Agriculture, and he moved to Washington saying that he would solve the problems of the farmers or he would go back to Iowa. And he was the one who went to FDR very early in the 100 days and said, we need a big farm bill. He got FDR to agree to that. He was the one who convened the farm leaders to find out what should be in the bill, and they agreed it should be the system of paying farmers not to grow crops. And that was a very radical idea, to send out checks to hundreds of thousands of farmers.
Must have been.
Huge. And, you know, in fact, Republicans attacked the Agricultural Adjustment Act when it was in Congress, and they said the reason that the bill was so complicated is it was translated from the original Russian, you know. It was just regarded as so way out there. But it was adopted, and, you know, it worked. They did send out all these checks. Farmers did start putting aside some land and growing less crops. Crop prices, which had fallen so low that it didn't pay for farmers to plant any crops because it cost more to raise them than they could sell them for, were suddenly growing crops again, and there was a market for these commodities again. So it all actually worked, and that was really Wallace's genius and FDR's, you know, genius in supporting him.
Yeah. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. Adam Cullen is our guest, author of the book, which has just been published in paperback. He's a member of the New York Times editorial board. We have a couple lines open if you've been trying to get through. 800-486-8655 is our studio number. Our email address, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Cullen, our guest. Here's an email that's come in, Adam. Jeff from West Bend. Were some of the New Deal programs like Social Security and unemployment insurance initially set up to have time limits, i.e. they would be phased out when the economy got better? And also, were FDR's programs really effective in getting the U.S. out of the Depression?
Some programs were supposed to have time limits. The major one there was the Agricultural Adjustment Act was thought to be a temporary measure, and we still have major farm subsidies. Social Security, no. Unemployment insurance, no. FDR really envisioned this as something that would be a permanent part of American life. And one reason he actually set up Social Security the way he did, with employer contributions, and employee contributions, it didn't just come out of general revenues, is he wanted to be something that would be very hard for future generations of politicians to undo, because people could say that they put their own money and they were entitled to get it out. So he definitely had the long-term vision on that. As for what ended the Depression, it is true that World War II was really what brought the country out of the Depression, but it's sometimes being argued now that the New Deal didn't help. And that's really wrong. When you look at the impact of these major programs, the spending programs and so forth, unemployment went down sharply after 1933. Gross domestic product went up steadily. So these programs were working, and millions of families survived the Great Depression, those terrible years of 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, who would not have been able to survive without them. So there's a talking point out now that, oh, it was only World War II that saved the country, but the New Deal really did a huge part.
Bill from Madison, hi.
Hi. My grandparents both had small farms, one in northern Wisconsin and another one in northern Minnesota. And as a child, I knew Gus Hallberg. He was the president of the Communist Party. And Mamie Savander, who was from Iron River, Wisconsin. She was the daughter of the vice president of the Communist Party. And a lot of these nice people, they meant well, were gathered up by the FBI. Some of them went on their own, but many of them were gathered up by the FBI, sent over to Russia. And they were shot. I don't know if you know about that. I'm 75 years old. I'm writing a book on that. But the thing about it is there's a lot that's been covered up. It is sad what happened to these nice people.
Adam, you want to comment?
That's an amazing story. I hope you do write that book because that is a story that should be told. I mean, people know in a general way, I think, that during the McCarthy era, people who supported communism, not even just communists, but, you know, so-called fellow travelers, were often treated very badly. They often lost their jobs and were unable to support themselves. So there was a lot of bad, results for people who were left-wing during the 50s in particular. But I did not know that about the farm communists, and it's a terrible story, about them being sent back to Russia. So I would love to learn more about it.
Yeah. Thank you, Bill, for your call. We go next to Nancy from Grafton. Hi, Nancy.
Well, good morning. My father had a farm. Well, he's a single guy. He had a farm in Marathon County, and he couldn't make the mortgage. And he said, well, take the darn farm. I don't care. Well, no, Frank. You just stay on that farm, and you farm it. So he did, and he got married. And in 1942, his mortgage had been cut, I believe, in half. He went to Wausau, the courthouse. He paid off his farm. He went to the hospital, picked up my mom and my little brother, Glenn, new baby, and he was a good farmer, and he farmed on that farm for many, many years and gave us a good living. So that's what happened with the Federal Land Bank. My dad got to keep his farm.
Huh.
I got to grow up on that farm.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Nancy. You want to comment, Adam?
That's a great story, and it's another indication of what I was saying, that people, who say we didn't need the New Deal, don't really appreciate how many lives it changed, how many people, got through the hard times because of these programs. And, that caller got to grow up on a family farm because of the New Deal. I mean, that's a beautiful story.
We go to Kurt from Superior. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, this is a great show.
Whoops, I'm sorry, Kurt. I think I know what he was going to ask, though, and we can do recommendations as well. You can call back, Kurt. I'm sorry. He wondered. It was my fault. I think I pressed the wrong button. If you have recommendations, we, of course, recommend your book, The Best Biographies of FDR.
Oh, The Best Biographies. There's a great book about the whole time period by David Kennedy called Freedom from Fear. A Harvard professor named Frank Friedel has written a number of FDR biographies, all quite good. But, I would also encourage people, one of the points of my book is the importance of the people around him. So I would also encourage them. There's a new biography out about Frances Perkins.
Oh, how is it? Yeah, we thought about getting that.
Yeah, no, it's quite nice.
Is it?
And I know the woman who wrote it, and we've appeared on some panels together.
Oh.
I would definitely recommend that. And there also are some good biographies of Henry Wallace. One written by former Senator Culver, American Dreamer. So, there are good FDR books, but I'd encourage people to wade into some of the people around him as well.
Okay. Ken from Milwaukee, we have about a minute left, everybody. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Two quick questions, if I may. How did FDR's having more than two terms influence enhance or hurt his ability to affect these policies? Did he actually want to run for more than two terms from the outset? And my second question is, with Frances Perkin being a woman, how did that affect things in the cabinet and her ability to get things done?
Great question. So on the first, I would say that when he was first elected, he probably didn't imagine he would have two terms because no one ever had. But I think once he was in office, he really got addicted to the idea of it and didn't want to leave, obviously. I think it was very important that he stayed in longer because the Depression had continued, and he was able to do a lot of things in his third term as well, including things like the Fair Labor Standards Act, minimum wages and maximum hours. So, and then, of course, it also allowed him to be there to fight World War II, which I think everyone agrees he did a great job with. So that's on the terms. Frances Perkins was such an oddity as a woman. People didn't know what to do about her. They couldn't imagine what a woman cabinet member would be like. They didn't know what to call her. They didn't know what words to use. And she was always trying to prove that she was as good as the men. And, one thing she was very concerned about is that people not think that she talked too much at cabinet meetings because of the reputation women had for talking too much. So she talks in her oral history about how she tried to make her points very concisely. And then, and she also tried to never be late because she was worried that people would think that a woman cabinet member would be late. But, in many ways, I think she just was a great cabinet secretary.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Adam, thank you so much. Great interview. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show, John Anderson for on-air production, and we'll be with you again tomorrow at 9. Thanks for listening.